Yang Guan pushed the doctor aside off his stool. He darted right to his wife's face.
I am here. Reverend Yu came with me, Lien.
It was like a light coming on in a darkened room.
Quan!
Lien Hua cried out, feeling her need to push, and finally wanting to. But then things became more complicated still. The hospital had its own security personnel, but on being alerted by the clerk in the main lobby, one of them called for the police, who, unlike the hospital's own personnel, were armed. Two of them appeared in the corridor, surprised, first of all, to see foreigners with TV equipment right there in front of them. Ignoring them, they pushed into the delivery room to find a pregnant woman about to deliver, a doctor on the floor, and four men, two of them foreigners as well.
"What goes on here?" the senior one bellowed, since intimidation was a major tool for controlling people in the PRC.
"These people are interfering with my duties," the doctor answered with a shout of his own.
If he didn't act fast, the damn baby would be born and breathe. And then he couldn't...
"What?"
the cop demanded of him.
"This woman has an unauthorized pregnancy, and it is my duty to terminate the fetus now. These people are in my way. Please remove them from the room."
That was enough for the cops. They turned to the obviously unauthorized visitors.
"You will leave now," the senior one ordered, while the junior one kept his hand on his service pistol.
"No,"
was the immediate reply, both from Yang Quan and Yu Fa An.
"The doctor has given his order. You must leave," the cop insisted.
He was unaccustomed to having ordinary people resist his orders.
"You will go now."
The doctor figured this was the cue for him to complete his distasteful duty, so that he could go home for the day. He set the stool back up and slid it to where he needed to be.
"You will not do this."
This time it was Yu, speaking with all the moral authority his education and status could provide.
"Will you get him out of here?" the doctor growled at the cops,
as he slid the stool back in place. Quan was ill-positioned to do anything, standing as he was by his wife's head. To his horror, he saw the doctor lift the syringe and adjust his glasses. Just then his wife, who might as well have been in another city for the past 2 minutes, took a deep breath and pushed.
"Ah,"
the doctor said. The fetus was fully crowned now, and all he had to do was... Reverend Yu had seen as much evil in his life as most clergymen, and they see as much as any seasoned police officer. But to see a human baby murdered before his eyes was just too much. He roughly shoved the junior of the two policemen aside and struck the doctor's head from behind, flinging him to the right and jumping on top of him.
"Getting this?" Barry Wise asked in the corridor.
"Yep," Nichols confirmed.
What offended the junior policeman was not the attack on the doctor, but rather the fact that this citizen had laid hands on a uniformed member of the Armed People's Police. Outraged, he drew his pistol from its holster, and what had been a confused situation became a deadly one.
"No!"
shouted Cardinal DeMilo, moving toward the young cop. He turned to see the source of the noise and saw an elderly Guai, or foreigner in very strange clothes, moving toward him with a hostile expression. The cop's first response was a blow to the foreigner's face, delivered with his empty left hand. Renato Cardinal DeMilo hadn't been physically struck since his childhood, and the affront to his personhood was all the more offensive for his religious and diplomatic status. And to be struck by this child! He turned back from the force of the blow and pushed the man aside, wanting to go to Yu's aid, and to help him keep this murderous doctor away from the baby about to be born. The doctor was wavering on one foot, holding the syringe up in the air. This the cardinal seized in his hand and hurled against the wall, where it didn't break because it was plastic, but the metal needle bent. Had the police better understood what was happening, or had they merely been better trained, it would have stopped there. But they hadn't, and it didn't. Now the senior cop had his Type 77 pistol out. This he used to club the Italian on the back of the head. But his blow was poorly delivered, and all it managed to do was knock him off balance and split his skin.
Now it was Monsignor Shepka's turn. His cardinal, the man whom it was his duty to serve and protect, had been attacked. He was a priest. He couldn't use deadly force. He couldn't attack. But he could defend. That he did, grasping the older officer's gun hand and twisting it up in a safe direction, away from the others in the room. But there it went off, and though the bullet merely flattened out in the concrete ceiling, the noise inside the small room was deafening. The younger policeman suddenly thought that his comrade was under attack. He wheeled and fired, but missed Shepka, and struck Cardinal DeMilo in the back. The 30-caliber bullet transited the body back to front, damaging the churchman's spleen. The pain surprised DeMilo, but his eyes were focused on the emerging baby. The crash of the shot had startled Lianhua, and the push that followed was pure reflex. The baby emerged, and would have fallen headfirst to the hard floor but for the extended hands of Reverend Yu, who stopped the fall and probably saved the newborn's life. He was lying on his side, and then he saw that the second shot had gravely wounded his Catholic friend. Holding the baby, he struggled to his feet and looked vengefully at the youthful policeman. "Huai Dan!" he shouted. "Villain!" Oblivious of the infant in his arms, he lurched forward toward the confused and frightened policeman. As automatically as a robot, the younger cop merely extended his arm and shot the Baptist preacher right in the forehead. Yu twisted and fell, bumping into Cardinal DeMilo's supine form and landing on his back, so that his chest cushioned the newborn's fall. "Put that away!" the older cop screamed at his young partner. But the damage had been done. The Chinese Reverend Yu was dead, the back of his head leaking brain matter and venting blood at an explosive rate onto the dirty tile floor. The doctor was the first to take any intelligent action. The baby was out now, and he couldn't kill it. He took it from Yu's dead arms and held it up by the feet, planning to smack it on the rump. But it cried out on its own. So, the doctor thought as automatically as the second policeman shot, this lunacy has one good result. That he'd been willing to kill it 60 seconds before was another issue entirely. Then it had been unauthorized tissue. Now it was a breathing citizen of the People's Republic, and his duty as a physician was to protect it. The dichotomy did not trouble him because it never even occurred to him. There followed a few seconds in which people tried to come to terms with what had happened. Monsignor Shepka saw that Yu was dead. He couldn't be alive with that head wound. His remaining duty was to his cardinal. "Eminence," he said, kneeling down to lift him off the bloody floor. Renato Cardinal DeMilo thought it strange that there was so little pain, for he knew that his death was imminent. Inside, his spleen was lacerated, and he was bleeding out internally at a lethal rate. He had not the time to reflect on his life or what lay in his immediate future. But despite that, his life of service and faith reasserted itself one more time. "The child, Franz. The child?" he asked in a gasping voice. "The baby lives," Monsignor Shepka told the dying man. A gentle smile. "Bene," Renato said, before closing his eyes for the last time. The last shot taken by the CNN crew was of the baby lying on her mother's chest. They didn't know her name, and the woman's face was one of utter confusion. But then she felt her daughter, and the face was transformed as womanly instincts took over completely. "We better get the fuck out of here, Barry," the cameraman advised with a hiss. "I think you're right, Pete." Wise stepped back and started to his left to get down the corridor to the stairs. He had a potential Emmy-class story in his hands now. He'd seen a human drama with few equals, and it had to go out. And it had to go out fast. Inside the delivery room, the senior cop was shaking his head, his ears still ringing, trying to figure out what the hell had happened here, when he realized that the light level was lower. The TV camera was gone. He had to do something. Standing erect, he darted from the room and looked right, and saw the last American disappear into the stairwell. He left his junior in the delivery room and ran that way, turned into the fire stairs and ran downstairs as fast as gravity could propel him. Wise led his people into the main lobby and right toward the main door, where their satellite van was. They'd almost made it, when a shout made them turn. It was the cop, the older one, about 40, they thought, and his pistol was out again, to the surprise and alarm of the civilians in the lobby. "Keep going," Wise told his crew, and they pushed through the doors into the open air. The van was in view, with the mini-satellite dish lying flat on the roof, and that was the key to getting this story out. "Stop!" the cop called. He knew some English, so it would seem. "Okay, guys, let's play it real cool," Wise told the other three. "Under control," Pete the cameraman advised. The camera was off his shoulder now, and his hands were out of casual view. The cop holstered his pistol and came close, with his right hand up and out flat.
"Give me tape," he said. "Give me tape."
His accent was crummy, but his English was understandable enough. "That tape is my property," Wise protested. "It belongs to me and my company." The cop's English wasn't that good. He just repeated his demand.
"Give me tape!"
"Okay, Barry," Pete said. "I got it." The cameraman, his name was Peter Nichols, lifted the camera up and hit the eject button, punching the beta format tape out of the Sony camera. This he gave to the police officer with a downcast and angry expression. The cop took it with his own expression of satisfaction and turned on his heel to go back into the hospital. There was no way he could have known that, like any news cameraman, Pete Nichols could deal seconds as skillfully as any Las Vegas poker dealer. He winked at Barry Wise, and the four headed off to the van.
"Send it up now?" the producer asked.
"Let's not be too obvious about it," Wise thought. "Let's move a few blocks." This they did, heading west toward Tiananmen Square, where a news van doing a satellite transmission wasn't out of the ordinary. Wise was already on his satellite phone to Atlanta. "This is Wise Mobile in Beijing with an upload," the correspondent said into the phone. "Hey, Barry," a familiar voice said in reply. "This is Ben Golden. What you got for us?"
"It's hot," Wise told his controller half a world away.
"A double murder and a childbirth. One guy who got whacked is a Catholic cardinal, the Vatican ambassador to Beijing. The other one's a Chinese Baptist minister. They were both shot on camera. You might want to call legal about it."
"Fuck," Atlanta observed.
"We're uploading the rough cut now, just so you get it. I'll stand by to do the talking. But let's get the video uploaded first."
"Roger that. We're standing by on channel 06.
06, Pete," Wise told his cameraman, who also ran the uplink. Nichols was kneeling by the control panels.
"Standing by. Tapes in. Setting up for 6. Transmitting now."
And with that, the Q-band signal went racing upward through the atmosphere to the satellite, hovering 22,800 miles directly over the Admiralty Islands in the Bismarck Sea. CNN doesn't bother encrypting its video signals. To do so is technically inconvenient, and few people bother pirating signals they could just as easily get off their cable systems for free in a few minutes, or even get live just 4 seconds later. But this one was coming in at an awkward hour, which was, however, good for CNN Atlanta, because some headquarters people would want to go over it. A shooting death was not what the average American wanted with his Rice Krispies in the morning. It was also downloaded by the American intelligence community, which holds CNN in very high regard, and doesn't distribute its news coverage very far in any case. But this one did go to the White House Office of Signals, a largely military operation located in the basement of the West Wing. There, a watch officer had to decide how important it was.
If it ranked as a critic priority, the president had to know about it in 15 minutes, which meant waking him up right now, which was not something to be done casually to the commander-in-chief. A mere flash could wait a little longer, like... The watch officer checked the wall clock. Yeah, like until breakfast. So instead, they called the president's national security advisor, Dr. Benjamin Goodley. They'd let him make the call. He was a carded national intelligence officer. Yeah? Goodley snarled into the phone while he checked the clock radio next to his bed. Dr. Goodley, this is Signals. We just copied something off CNN from Beijing that the boss is going to be interested in. What is it? Card Sharp asked. Then he heard the reply. How certain are you of this? The Italian guy looks like he might possibly have survived from the video. I mean, if there was a good surgeon close. But the Chinese minister had his brains blowed right out. No chance for him at all, sir. What was it all about? We're not sure of that. NSA might have the phone conversation between this wise guy and Atlanta, but we haven't seen anything about it yet. Okay, tell me what you got again, Goodley ordered, now that he was approximately awake. Sir, we have a visual of two guys getting shot and a baby being born in Beijing. The video comes from Barry Wise of CNN. The video shows three gunshots. One is upwards into the ceiling of what appears to be a hospital delivery room. The second shot catches a guy in the back. That guy is identified as the papal nuncio to Beijing. The third shot goes right into the head of a guy identified as a Baptist minister in Beijing. That one appears to be a Chinese national. In between, we have a baby being born. Now we... Stand by a minute, Dr. Goodley. Okay, I have flash traffic from Fort Meade. Okay, they got it too, and they got a voice transmission via their echelon system, reading it now. Okay, the Catholic cardinal is dead, according to this. Says Cardinal Renato de Milo. Can't check the spelling, maybe State Department for that. And the Chinese minister is a guy named Yu Fa An. Again, no spelling check. They were there to, Okay, they were there to prevent a late-term abortion, and looks like they succeeded. But these two clergy got their asses killed doing it. Third one, a Monsignor named Franz Schepke. That sounds pretty German to me. Was there too, and looks like he survived. Oh, okay, he must be the tall one you see on the tape. You gotta see the tape. It's a hell of a confused mess, sir, and when this you guy gets it, well, it's like that video from Saigon during the Tet Offensive. You know where the South Vietnamese police colonel shot the North Vietnamese spy in the side of the head with a Smith Chief special, you know, like a fountain of blood coming out the head? Ain't something to watch with your Egg McMuffin, you know, the watch officer observed. The reference came across clearly enough. The news media had celebrated the incident as an example of the South Vietnamese government's bloodthirstiness. They had never explained, probably never even knew, that the man shot had been an officer of the North Vietnamese Army captured in a battle zone wearing civilian clothing. Therefore, under the Geneva Protocols, was a spy liable to summary execution, which was exactly what he'd received. Okay, what else? Do we wake the boss up for this? I mean, we got a diplomatic team over there, and this has some serious implications. Goodley thought about that for a second or two. No, I'll brief him in a few hours. Sir, it's sure as hell going to be on CNN's 7 o'clock morning report, the watch officer warned. Well, let me brief him when we have more than just pictures. Your call, Dr. Goodley. Thanks. Now I think I'll try to get one more hour before I drive over to Langley. The phone went down before Goodley heard a reaction. His job carried a lot of prestige, but it denied him sleep and much of a social or sex life. And at moments like this, he wondered what the hell was so goddamned prestigious about it. Chapter 25 Fence Rending. The speed of modern communications makes for curious disconnects. In this case, the American government knew what had happened in Beijing long before the government of the People's Republic did. What appeared in the White House Office of Signals appeared also in the State Department's Operations Center. And there the senior officer present had decided, naturally enough, to get the information immediately to the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. There, Ambassador Carl Hitch took the call at his desk on the encrypted line. He forced the caller from Foggy Bottom to confirm the news twice before making his first reaction, a whistle. It wasn't often that an accredited ambassador of any sort got killed in a host country, much less by a host country. What the hell, he wondered, was Washington going to do about this?
Damn, Hitch whispered.
He hadn't even met Cardinal DeMillo yet. The official reception had been planned for 2 weeks from now in a future that would never come. What was he supposed to do? First, he figured, get off a message of condolence to the Vatican mission. Foggy Bottom would so notify the Vatican through the nuncio in Washington, probably. Maybe even Secretary Adler would drive over himself to offer official condolences. Hell, President Ryan was Catholic, and maybe he would go himself, Hitch speculated. Okay, Hitch told himself, things to do here. He had his secretary call the nuncio's residence, but all he got there was a Chinese national answering the phone, and that wasn't worth a damn. That would have to go on the back burner. What about the Italian embassy? He thought next. The nuncio was an Italian citizen, wasn't he? Probably. Okay. He checked his card file and dialed up the Italian ambassador's private line. Paolo, this is Carl Hitch.
Well, thanks, and you?
I have some bad news, I'm afraid. The papal nuncio, Cardinal DeMillo, he's been shot and killed in some Beijing hospital by a Chinese policeman.
It's going to be on CNN soon. Not sure how soon.
We're pretty certain of it, I'm afraid.
I'm not entirely sure, but what I've been told is that he was there trying to prevent the death of a child, or one of those late-term abortions they do here.
Yeah.
Say, doesn't he come from a prominent family?
Then Hitch started taking notes. Vincenzo, you said?
I see. Minister of Justice 2 years ago?
I tried to call over there, but all I got was some local answering the phone.
German?
Shepke?
More notes.
I see. Thank you, Paolo.
Hey, if there's anything we can help you with over here.
Right.
Okay, bye.
He hung up.
Damn, now what? He asked the desk.
He could spread the bad news to the German embassy, but no, he'd let someone else do that. For now, he checked his watch. It was still short of sunrise in Washington, and the people there would wake up to find a firestorm. His job, he figured, was to verify what had happened so that he could make sure Washington had good information. But how the hell to do that? His best potential source of information was this Monsignor Shepke. But the only way to get him was to stake out the Vatican embassy and wait for him to come home.
Would the Chinese be holding him somewhere?
No, probably not. Once their foreign ministry found out about this, they'd probably fall all over themselves trying to apologize. So they'd put extra security on the nuncio's place, and that would keep newsies away. But they're not going to mess with accredited diplomats, not after killing one. This was just so bizarre. Carl Hitch had been a foreign service officer since his early 20s. He'd never come across anything like this before. At least not since Spike Dobbs had been held hostage in Afghanistan by guerrillas, and the Russians had screwed up the rescue mission and gotten him killed. Some said that had been deliberate, but even the Soviets weren't that dumb, Hitch thought. Similarly, this hadn't been a deliberate act either. The Chinese were communists, and communists didn't gamble that way. It just wasn't part of their nature or their training. So how had this happened? And what exactly had happened? And when would he tell Cliff Rutledge about it? And what effect might this have on the trade talks? Carl Hitch figured he'd have a full evening. "The People's Republic will not be dictated to," Foreign Minister Shen Tang concluded.
"Minister,"
Rutledge replied, "it is not the intention of the United States to dictate to anyone. You make your national policy to suit your nation's needs. We understand and respect that. We require, however, that you understand and respect our right to make our national policy as well, to suit our country's needs. In this case, that means invoking the provisions of the Trade Reform Act." That was a big, sharp sword to wave. And everyone in the room knew it, Mark Gant thought. The TRA enabled the executive branch to replicate any nation's trade laws as applied to American goods, and mirror-image them against that nation's own goods. It was international proof of the adage that the shoe could sure pinch if it was on the other foot. In this case, everything China did to exclude American manufactured goods from the Chinese marketplace would simply be invoked in order to do the same to Chinese goods. And with a trade surplus of $70 billion per year, that could well mean $70 billion. All of it hard currency. The money to buy the things the PRC government wanted from America or elsewhere wouldn't be there anymore. Trade would become trade. One of mine for one of yours. Which was the theory that somehow never became reality.
If America embargoes Chinese trade, China can and will do the same to America,
Shen shot back.
Which serves neither your purposes nor our own, Rutledge responded.
And that dog ain't gonna hunt, he didn't have to say. The Chinese knew that well enough without being told.
And what of most favored nation status for our country? What of entry into the World Trade Organization?
The Chinese foreign minister demanded.
Mr. Minister, America cannot look favorably upon either so long as your country expects open export markets while closing your import markets.
Trade, sir, means trade. The even exchange of your goods for ours, Rutledge pointed out again.
About the 12th time since lunch, he reckoned. Maybe the guy would get it this time. But that was unfair. He already got it. He just wasn't acknowledging the fact. It was just domestic Chinese politics projected into the international arena.
And again you dictate to the People's Republic, Shen replied,
with enough anger, real or feigned, to suggest that Rutledge had usurped his parking place.
No, Minister, we do no such thing. It is you, sir, who tried to dictate to the United States of America. You say that we must accept your trade terms. In that, sir, you are mistaken. We see no more need to buy your goods than you do to buy ours.
Just that you need our hard cash a damn sight more than we need your chew toys for our fucking dogs.
We can buy our airliners from Airbus just as easily as from Boeing.
This really was getting tiresome. Rutledge wanted to respond.
But without our dollars, what will you pay for them with, Charlie?
But Airbus had excellent credit terms for its customers, one more way in which a European government-subsidized enterprise played fair in the marketplace with a private American corporation. So instead he said,
"Yes, Mr. Minister, you can do that. And we can buy trade goods from Taiwan, or Korea, or Thailand, or Singapore, just as easily as we can buy them here.
And they'll fucking well buy their airplanes from Boeing."
"But that does not serve the needs of your people, or of ours," he concluded reasonably.
"We are a sovereign nation and a sovereign people," Shen retorted, continuing on as he had before,
and Rutledge figured that the rhetoric was all about taking command of the verbiage. It was a strategy that had worked many times before. But Rutledge had instructions to disregard all the diplomatic theatrics, and the Chinese just hadn't caught on yet. Maybe in a few more days, he thought.
"As are we, Minister," Rutledge said when Shen concluded.
Then he ostentatiously checked his watch, and here Shen took the cue.
"I suggest we adjourn until tomorrow," the PRC foreign minister said.
"Good. I look forward to seeing you in the morning, Minister," Rutledge responded, rising and leaning across the table to shake hands.
The rest of the party did the same, though Mark Gant didn't have a counterpart to be nice to at the moment. The American party shuffled out, downstairs, toward their waiting cars.
"Well, that was lively," Gant observed, as soon as they were outside.
Rutledge actually had himself a nice grin.
"Yeah, it was kind of diverting, wasn't it?"
A pause.
"I think they're exploring how far Bluster can take them. Shen is actually rather a sedate kind of guy. He likes it nice and gentle most of the time."
"So he has his instructions, too?" Gant wondered.
"Of course, but he reports to a committee, their Politburo, whereas we report to Scott Adler, and he reports to President Ryan. You know, I was a little mad about the instructions I had coming over here. But this is actually turning into fun. We don't get to snarl back at people very often. We're the U.S. of A., and we're supposed to be nice and calm and accommodating to everybody. That's what I'm used to doing. But this feels good."
That didn't mean that he approved of President Ryan, of course, but switching over from canasta to poker made an interesting change. Scott Adler liked poker, didn't he? Maybe that explained why he got along so well with that yahoo in the White House. It was a short drive back to the embassy. The Americans in the delegation rode mainly in silence, blessing the few minutes of quiet. The hours of precise diplomatic exchange had had to be attended to in the same way a lawyer read a contract, word by goddamned word, seeking meaning and nuance, like searching for a lost diamond in a cesspool. Now they sat back in their seats and closed their eyes or looked mutely at the passing drab scenery with no more than an unstifled yawn, until they pulled through the embassy gate. About the only thing to complain about was the fact that the limousines here, like those everywhere, were hard to get in and out of, unless you were 6 years old. But as soon as they alighted from their official transport, they could see that something was wrong. Ambassador Hitch was right there, and he hadn't bothered with that before. Ambassadors have high diplomatic rank and importance. They do not usually act as doormen for their own countrymen.
"What's the matter, Carl?" Rutledge asked.
"A major bump in the road," Hitch answered.
"Somebody die?" the Deputy Secretary of State asked lightly.
"Yeah," was the unexpected answer. Then the ambassador waved them inside. "Come on." The senior delegation members followed Rutledge into the ambassador's conference room. Already there, they saw, were the DCM, the Deputy Chief of Mission, the ambassador's XO, who in many embassies was the real boss, and the rest of the senior staff, including the guy Gant had figured was the CIA station chief.
What the hell, Telescope thought.
They all took their seats, and then Hitch broke the news.
"Oh, shit," Rutledge said for them all. "Why did this happen?"
"We're not sure. We have our press attaché trying to track this wise guy down. But until we get more information, we really don't know the cause of the incident." Hitch shrugged.
"Does the PRC know?" Rutledge asked next.
"Probably they're just finding out," the putative CIA officer opined. "You have to assume the news took a while to percolate through their bureaucracy."
"How do we expect them to react?" one of Rutledge's underlings asked, sparing his boss the necessity of asking the obvious and fairly dumb question.
The answer was just as dumb.
"Your guess is as good as mine," Hitch said.
"So this could be a minor embarrassment or a major whoopsie," Rutledge observed. "Whoopsie is a term of art in the United States Department of State, usually meaning a massive fuck-up."
"I'd lean more toward the latter," Ambassador Hitch thought.
He couldn't come up with a rational explanation for why this was so, but his instincts were flashing a lot of bright red lights, and Carl Hitch was a man who trusted his instincts.
"Any guidance from Washington?" Cliff asked.
"They haven't woken up yet, have they?" And as one, every member of the delegation checked his watch.
The embassy people already had, of course. The sun had not yet risen on their national capital. What decisions would be made would happen in the next 4 hours. Nobody here would be getting much sleep for a while, because once the decisions were made, then they'd have to decide how to implement them, how to present the position of their country to the People's Republic.
Ideas? Rutledge asked.
The president won't like this very much, Gant observed, figuring he knew about as much as anyone else in the room. His initial reaction will be one of disgust. Question is, will that spill over into what we're here for? I think it might, depending on how our Chinese friends react to the news.
How will the Chinese react? Rutledge asked Hitch.
Not sure, Cliff, but I doubt we'll like it. They will regard the entire incident as an intrusion, an interference with their internal affairs. And their reaction will be somewhat crass, I think. Essentially, they're going to say, too damn bad. If they do, there's going to be a visceral reaction in America and in Washington. They don't understand us as well as they'd like to think they do. They misread our public opinion at every turn, and they haven't showed me much sign of learning.
I'm worried, Hitch concluded.
Well, then it's our job to walk them through this. You know, Rutledge thought aloud, this could work in favor of our overall mission here.
Hitch bristled at that.
Cliff, it would be a serious mistake to try to play this one that way. Better to let them think it through for themselves. The death of an ambassador is a big deal, the American ambassador told the people in the room, in case they didn't know. All the more so if the guy was killed by an agent of their government. But Cliff, if you try to shove this down their throats, they're going to choke. And I don't think we want that to happen either. I think our best play is to ask for a break of a day or two in the talks, to let them get their act together.
That's a sign of weakness for our side, Carl, Rutledge replied with a shake of the head.
I think you're wrong on that. I think we press forward and let them know that the civilized world has rules and we expect them to abide by them.
What lunacy is this? Feng Gan asked the ceiling.
We are not sure, Zhang Hansan replied. Some troublesome churchman, it sounds like.
And some foolish policeman with more gun than brains.
He'll be punished, of course, Feng suggested.
Punished? For what? For enforcing our population control laws? For protecting a doctor against an attack by some guai?
Zhang shook his head.
Do we allow foreigners to spit upon our laws in this way?
No, Feng, we do not. I will not see us lose face in such a way.
Zhang, what is the life of one insignificant police officer next to our country's place in the world? Feng demanded.
The man he killed was an ambassador, Zhang, a foreigner, accredited to our country by another.
Country?
Zhang spat.
A city, my friend. No, not even that. A district in Rome smaller than Chongdao.
He referred to Jade Island, home of one of the many temples built by the emperors, and not much larger than the building itself. Then he remembered a quote from Joseph Stalin.
How big an army does that Pope have, anyway? Ah!
A dismissive wave of the hand.
He does have a country, whose ambassador we accredited in the hope of improving our position in the diplomatic world, Feng reminded his friend. His death is to be regretted, at the least. Perhaps he was merely one more troublesome foreign devil, Zhang, but for the purposes of diplomacy we must appear to regret his passing.
And if that meant executing some nameless policeman, they had plenty of policemen, Feng didn't add.
For what? For interfering with our laws? An ambassador may not do such a thing. That violates diplomatic protocol, does it not?
Feng, you have become overly solicitous to the foreign devils, Zhang concluded, using the term from history to identify the lesser people from those lesser lands.
If we want their goods in trade and we want them to pay for our goods so that we might have their hard currency, then we must treat them like guests in our home.
A guest in your home does not spit on the floor, Feng.
and if the Americans do not react kindly to this incident?
Then Shen will tell them to mind their own affairs, Zhang replied, with the finality of one who had long since made up his mind.
When does the Politburo meet?
To discuss this?
Zhang asked in surprise.
Why? The death of some foreign troublemaker and a Chinese churchman?
Fang, you are too cautious. I have already discussed the incident with Shen.
There will be no full meeting of the Politburo for this trivial incident. We will meet the day after tomorrow as usual.
As you say, Fang responded with a nod of submission. Zhang had him ranked on the Politburo. He had much influence with the foreign and defense ministries, and the ear of Xu Kunpiao. Fang had his own political capital, mainly for internal matters, but less such capital than Zhang, and so he had to spend it carefully, when it could profit himself. This was not such a case, he thought. With that, he went back to his office and called Ming to transcribe his notes. Then, later, he thought, he'd have Chai come in. She was so useful in easing the tension of his day. He felt better on waking this morning than was usually the case, probably because he'd gotten to sleep at a decent hour, Jack told himself, on the way to the bathroom for the usual morning routine. You never got a day off here, at least not in the sense that most people understood the term. You never really got to sleep late. 8:25 was the current record, dating all the way back to that terrible winter day when this had begun. And every day you had to have the same routine, including the dreaded national security briefing, which told you that some people really did believe that the world couldn't get on without you. The usual look in the mirror. He needed a haircut, Jack saw. But for that the barber came here, which wasn't a bad deal, really, except that you lost the fellowship of sitting in a male place and discussing male things. Being the most powerful man in the world insulated you from so many of the things that mattered. The food was good, and the booze was just fine. And if you didn't like the sheets, they were changed at the speed of light, and people jumped to the sound of your voice. Henry VIII never had it so good. But Jack Ryan had never thought to become a crowned monarch. That whole idea of kingship had died across the world except in a few distant places, and Ryan didn't live in one of them. But the entire routine at the White House seemed designed to make him feel like a king, and that was disturbing on a level that was like grasping a cloud of cigarette smoke. It was there, but every time you tried to hold it, the damn stuff just vanished. The staff was just so eager to serve, grimly but pleasantly, determined to make everything easy for them. The real worry was the effect this might have on his kids. If they started thinking they were princes and princesses, sooner or later their lives would go to hell in one big hurry. But that was his problem to worry about, Jack thought as he shaved. His and Kathy's. Nobody else could raise their kids for them. That was their job. Just that all of this White House crap got in the way practically all the time. The worst part of all, however, was that he had to be dressed all the time. Except in bed or in the bathroom, the president had to be properly dressed. Or what would the staff think? So Ryan couldn't walk out into the corridor without pants and at least some kind of shirt. At home, a normal person would have padded around barefoot in his shorts. But while a truck driver might have that freedom in his own home, the president of the United States did not have that freedom in his. Then he had to smile wryly at the mirror. He bitched to himself about the same things every morning, and if he really wanted to change them, he could. But he was afraid to. Afraid to take action that would cause people to lose their jobs. Aside from the fact that it would really look shitty in the papers, and practically everything he did made it into the news, it would feel bad to him, here, shaving every morning. And he didn't really need to walk out to the box and get the paper in the morning, did he?
and if you factored out the dress code, it wasn't all that bad. The breakfast buffet was actually quite nice, though it wasted at least 5 times the food it actually served. His cholesterol was still in the normal range, and so Ryan enjoyed eggs for his morning meal 2 or even 3 times a week, somewhat to his wife's distaste. The kids opted mainly for cereal or muffins. These were still warm from the downstairs kitchen and came in all sorts of healthy and tasty varieties. The early bird was the clipping service the government provided for senior officials. But for breakfast, swordsmen preferred the real paper, complete with cartoons. Like many, Ryan lamented the retirement of Gary Larson and the attendant loss of the morning Far Side. But Jack understood the pressure of enforced daily output. There was also a sports page to be read, something the early bird left out completely. And there was CNN, which started in the White House breakfast room promptly at 7. Ryan looked up when he heard the warning that kids should not see what they were about to show. His kids, like all other kids, stopped what they were doing to look.
"Ew, gross," Sally Ryan observed, when some Chinese guy got shot in the head.
"Head wounds do that," her mother told her, wincing even so. Kathy did surgery, but not that sort. "Jack, what's this all about?"
"You know as much as I do, honey," the president told the first lady.
Then the screen changed to some file tape showing a Catholic cardinal. Then Jack caught Papal Nuncio off the audio, leaning to reach for the controller to turn the sound up.
"Chuck," Ryan said to the nearest Secret Service agent, "get me Ben Goodley on the phone, if you could."
"Yes, Mr. President."
It took about 30 seconds. Then Ryan was handed the portable phone.
"Ben, what the hell's this thing out of Beijing?"
In Jackson, Mississippi, Reverend Jerry Patterson was accustomed to rising early in preparation for his morning jog around the neighborhood, and he turned on the bedroom TV while his wife went to fix his hot chocolate. Patterson didn't approve of coffee any more than he did of alcohol. His head turned at the words, "Reverend you," then his skin went cold when he heard, "A Baptist minister here in Beijing." He came back into the bedroom just in time to see a Chinese face go down and shoot out blood as from a garden hose. The tape didn't allow him to recognize a face.
"My God. Skip. God, no," the minister breathed, his morning suddenly and utterly disrupted.
Ministers deal with death on a daily basis, burying parishioners, consoling the bereaved, and treating God to look after the needs of both. But it was no easier for Jerry Patterson than it would have been for anyone else this day, because there had been no warning, no long illness to prepare the mind for the possibility, not even the fact of age to reduce the surprise factor. Skip was, what, 55? No more than that. Still a young man, Patterson thought, young and vigorous to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ to his flock. Dead? Killed, was it? Murdered? By whom? Murdered by that communist government? A man of God murdered by the godless heathen?
"Oh, shit," the president said over his eggs. "What else do we know, Ben? Anything from Zorga?"
Then Ryan looked around the room, realizing he'd spoken a word that was itself classified. The kids weren't looking his way, but Kathy was.
"Okay, we'll talk about it when you get in."
Jack hit the kill button on the phone and set it down.
"What's the story?"
"It's a real mess, babe," swordsman told surgeon. He explained what he knew for a minute or so. "The ambassador hasn't gotten to us with anything CNN didn't just show."
"You mean with all the money we spend on CIA and stuff, CNN is the best source of information we have?" Kathy Ryan asked, somewhat incredulously.
"You got it, honey," her husband admitted.
"Well, that doesn't make any sense."
Jack tried to explain.
CIA can't be everywhere, and it would look a little funny if all our field spooks carried video cams everywhere they went, you know.
Kathy made a face at being shut down so cavalierly.
But it's not that easy, Kathy, and the news people are in the same business gathering information. And occasionally they get there first.
But you have other ways of finding things out, don't you?
Kathy, you don't need to know about things like that, POTUS told FLOTUS.
That was a phrase she'd heard before, but not one she'd ever learned to love. Kathy went back to her morning paper while her husband graduated to the early bird. The Beijing story, Jack saw, had happened too late for the morning editions. One more thing to chuff up the TV newsies and annoy the print ones. Somehow the debate over the federal education budget didn't seem all that important this morning. But he'd learned to scan the editorials, because they tended to reflect the questions the reporters would ask at the press conference. And that was one way for him to defend himself. By 7:45, the kids were about ready for their drive to school, and Kathy was ready for her flight to Hopkins. Kyle Daniel went with her, with his own Secret Service detail, composed exclusively of women who would look after him at the Hopkins Daycare Center, rather like a pack of she-wolves. Katie would head back to her daycare center, the rebuilt Giant Steps north of Annapolis. There were fewer kids there now, but a larger protective detail. The big kids went to St. Mary's. On cue, the Marine VH-60 Black Hawk helicopter eased down on the South Lawn helipad. The day was about to start for real. The entire Ryan family took the elevator downstairs. First Mom and Dad walked the kids to the west entrance of the West Wing, where, after hugs and kisses, three of the kids got into their cars to drive off. Then Jack walked Kathy to the helicopter for the kiss goodbye. And the big Sikorsky lifted off under the control of Colonel Dan Malloy for the hop to Johns Hopkins. With that done, Ryan walked back to the West Wing and inside to the Oval Office. Ben Goodley was waiting for him.
"How bad?" Jack asked his national security adviser.
"Bad," Goodley replied at once.
"What was it all about?"
"They were trying to stop an abortion. The Chinese do them late term if the pregnancy is not government approved. They wait until just before the baby pops out and zap it in the top of the head with a needle before it gets to take a breath. Evidently, the woman on the tape was having an unauthorized baby, and her minister, that's the Chinese guy who gets it in the head, a Baptist preacher educated evidently at Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma, would you believe? Anyway, he came to the hospital to help. The papal nuncio, Renato Cardinal de Milo, evidently knew the Baptist preacher pretty well and came to offer assistance. It's hard to tell exactly what went wrong, but it blew up real bad, as the tape shows."
"Any statements?"
"The Vatican deplores the incident and has requested an explanation, but it gets worse. Cardinal de Milo is from the de Milo family. He has a brother, Vincenzo de Milo, who's in the Italian Parliament. He was a cabinet minister a while back. And so the Italian government has issued its own protest. Ditto the German government, because the cardinal's aide is a German monsignor named Schepke, who's a Jesuit, and he got a little roughed up, and the Germans aren't very happy either. This Monsignor Schepke was arrested briefly, but he was released after a few hours when the Chinese remembered he had diplomatic status. The thinking at state is that the PRC might PNG the guy, just to get him the hell out of the country and make the whole thing all go away."
"What time is it in Beijing?"
"Us minus 11, so it's 9 at night there," Card Sharp answered. "The trade delegation will need instructions of some sort about this. I need to talk to Scott Adler as soon as he gets in this morning."
"You need more than that, Jack."
It was the voice of Arnold Van Damme at the door to the office.
"What else?" The Chinese Baptist who got killed. I just heard he has friends over here.
Oral Roberts University, Ryan said. Ben told me.
The churchgoers are not going to like this one, Jack, Arnie warned.
Hey, guy, I don't goddamn like it, the president pointed out.
Hell, I don't like abortion under the best of circumstances, remember?
I remember, Van Damme said, recalling all the trouble Ryan had gotten into with his first presidential statement on the issue.
And this kind of abortion is especially barbaric. And so two guys go to the fucking hospital and try to save the baby's life, and they get killed for it.
Jesus, Ryan concluded. And we have to do business with people like this.
Then another face showed up at the door.
You've heard, I suppose, Robbie Jackson observed.
Oh, yeah. Hell of a thing to see over breakfast.
My pap knows the guy.
What? Ryan asked.
Remember at the reception last week? He told you about it. Pap and Jerry Patterson both support his congregation out of Mississippi. Some other congregations, too.
It's a Baptist thing, Jack.
Well-off churches look after ones that need help. And this you guy sure as hell needed help, looks like.
I haven't talked to him yet, but Pap is going to raise pure fucking hell about this one. And you can bet on it, the vice president informed his boss.
Who's Patterson? Van Damme asked.
White preacher, got a big air-conditioned church in the suburbs of Jackson.
Pretty good guy, actually. He and Pap have known each other forever. Patterson went through school with this you guy, I think.
This is going to get ugly, the chief of staff observed.
Arnie, baby, it's already ugly, Jackson pointed out.
The CNN cameraman had been a little too good, or had just been standing in a good place, and had caught both shots in all their graphic majesty.
What's your dad going to say? Ryan asked.
Tomcat made them wait for it.
He's going to call down the wrath of Almighty God on those murdering cocksuckers. He's going to call Reverend Yu a martyr to the Christian faith, right up there with the Maccabees of the Old Testament, and those courageous bastards the Romans fed to the lions. Arnie, have you ever seen a Baptist preacher calling down the vengeance of the Lord? It beats the hell out of the Super Bowl, boy, Robbie promised.
Reverend Yu is standing upright and proud before the Lord Jesus right now, and the guys who killed him have their rooms reserved in the everlasting fires of hell. Wait till you hear him go at it. It's impressive, guys. I've seen him do it. And Jerry Patterson won't be far behind.
And the hell of it is, I can't disagree with any of it.
Jesus, Ryan breathed. Those two men died to save the life of a baby. If you gotta die, that's not a bad reason for it.
They both died like men, Mr. C., Chavez was saying in Moscow. I wish I was there with a gun.
It had hit Ding especially hard.
Fatherhood had changed his perspective on a lot of things, and this was just one of them. The life of a child was sacrosanct, and a threat against a child was an invitation to immediate death in his ethical universe. And in the real universe, he was known to have a gun a lot of the time, and the training to use it efficiently.
Different people have different ways of looking at things, Clark told his subordinate.
But if he'd been there, he would have disarmed both of the Chinese cops. On the videotape, they hadn't looked all that formidable.
And you didn't kill people to make a fashion statement.
Domingo still had the Latin temperament, John reminded himself.
And that wasn't so bad a thing, was it?
What are you saying, John? Ding asked in surprise.
I'm saying two good men died yesterday, and I imagine God will look after both of them.
Ever been to China?
He shook his head.
Taiwan once, for R&R a long time ago.
That was okay, but aside from that, no closer than North Vietnam. I don't speak the language, and I can't blend in.
Both factors were distantly frightening to Clark. The ability to disappear into the surroundings was the sine qua non of being a field intelligence officer.
They were in a hotel bar in Moscow after their first day of lecturing their Russian students. The beer on tap was acceptable. Neither of them was in a mood for vodka. Life in Britain had spoiled them. This bar, which catered to Americans, had CNN on a large screen TV next to the bar. And this was CNN's lead story around the globe. The American government, the report concluded, hadn't reacted to the incident yet.
"So what's Jack going to do?" Chavez wondered.
"I don't know. We have that negotiations team in Beijing right now for trade talks," Clark reminded him.
"The diplomatic chatter might get a little sharp," Domingo thought.
"Scott, we can't let this one slide," Jack said. A call from the White House had brought Adler's official car here instead of Foggy Bottom.
"It is not, strictly speaking, pertinent to trade talks," the Secretary of State pointed out.
"Maybe you want to do business with people like that," Vice President Jackson responded, "but the people outside the Beltway might not."
"We have to consider public opinion on this, Scott," Ryan said.
"And you know we have to damn well consider my opinion. The murder of a diplomat is not something we can ignore. Italy is a NATO member, so is Germany. And we have diplomatic relations with the Vatican and about 70 million Catholics in the country, plus millions more Baptists."
"Okay, Jack," Eagle said, with raised defensive hands.
"I am not defending them, okay? I'm talking about the foreign policy of the United States of America here, and we're not supposed to manage that on the basis of emotions. The people out there pay us to use our heads, not our dicks."
Ryan let out a long breath.
"Okay, maybe I had that coming. Go on."
"We issue a statement deploring this sorry incident in strong language. We have Ambassador Hitch make a call on their foreign ministry and say the same thing. Maybe even stronger, but in more informal language. We give them a chance to think this mess through before they become an international pariah. Maybe discipline those trigger-happy cops. Hell, maybe shoot them, given how the law works over there. We let common sense break out, okay?"
"And what do I say?"
Adler thought that one over for a few seconds.
"Say whatever you want. We can always explain to them that we have a lot of churchgoers here and you have to assuage their sensibilities, that they have inflamed American public opinion, and in our country, public opinion counts for something. They know that on an intellectual level, but deep down in the gut, they don't get it. That's okay," Sextate went on. "Just so they get it in the brain, because the brain talks to the gut occasionally. They have to understand that the world doesn't like this sort of thing."
"And if they don't?" the Vice President asked.
"Well, then we have a trade delegation to show them the consequences of uncivilized behavior."
Adler looked around the room.
"Are we okay on that?"
Ryan looked down at the coffee table.
There were times when he wished he were a truck driver, able to scream out bloody murder when certain things happened. But that was just one more freedom the President of the United States didn't have.
"Okay, Jack, you have to be sensible and rational about all this." He looked up.
"Yes, Scott, we're sort of okay on that."
"Anything from our, new source on this issue?"
Ryan shook his head.
"No, MP hasn't sent anything over yet."
"If she does,
you'll get a copy real fast," the President promised.
"Get me some talking points. I'll have to make a statement. When, Arnie?"
11-ish ought to be okay," Van Damme decided. "I'll talk to some media guys about this."
"Okay, if anybody has ideas later today, I want to hear them," Ryan said, standing and adjourning the meeting.
Chapter 26 Glass Houses and Rocks. Fangan had worked late that day because of the incident that had Washington working early. As a result, Ming hadn't transcribed his discussion notes and her computer hadn't gotten them out on the net as early as usual. But Mary Pat got her email about 9:45. This she read over,
copied to her husband, Ed, and then shot via secure fax line to the White House, where Ben Goodley walked it to the Oval Office. The cover letter didn't contain Mary Pat's initial comment on reading the transmission. Oh, shit. Those cocksuckers, Ryan snarled, to the surprise of Andrea Price, who happened to be in the room just then. Anything I need to know about, sir? She asked. His voice had been so furious. No, Andrea, just that thing on CNN this morning. Ryan paused, blushing that she'd heard his temper let go again. And in that way. By the way, how's your husband doing? Well, he bagged those three bank robbers up in Philadelphia, and they did it without firing a shot. I was a little worried about that. Ryan allowed himself a smile. That's one guy I wouldn't want to have a shootout with. Tell me, you saw CNN this morning, right? Yes, sir, and we replayed it at the command post. Opinion? If I'd have been there, my weapon would have come out. That was cold-blooded murder. Looks bad on TV when you do dumb stuff like that, sir. Sure as hell does, the president agreed. He nearly asked her opinion on what he ought to do about it. Ryan respected Mrs. O'Day's, she still went by Price on the job, judgment. But it wouldn't have been fair to ask her to delve into foreign affairs. And besides, he already had his mind pretty well made up. But then he speed-dialed Adler's direct line on his phone. Yes, Jack? Only one person had that direct line. What do you make of the Zorga stuff? It's not surprising, unfortunately. You have to expect them to circle wagons. What do we do about it? Swordsman demanded. We say what we think, but we try not to make it worse than it already is, Sextate replied, cautious as ever. Right, Ryan growled, even though it was exactly the good advice he'd expected from his Sextate. Then he hung up. He reminded himself that Arnie had told him a long time ago that a president wasn't allowed to have a temper. But that was asking a hell of a lot. And at what point was he allowed to react the way a man needed to react? When was he supposed to stop acting like a goddamned robot? You want Callie to work up something for you in a hurry? Arnie asked over the phone. No, Ryan replied, with a shake of the head. I'll just wing it. Well, that's a mistake, the chief of staff warned. Arnie, just let me be me once in a while, okay? Okay, Jack, Van Damme replied. And it was just as well the president didn't see his expression. Don't make things worse than they already are, Ryan told himself at his desk. Yeah, sure, like that's possible. Hi, Pap, Robbie Jackson was saying in his office at the northwest corner of the West Wing. Robert, have you seen? Yes, we've all seen it, the vice president assured his father. And what are y'all going to do about it? Pap, we haven't figured that out yet. Remember that we have to do business with these people. The jobs of a lot of Americans depend on trade with China and... Robert. The Reverend Josiah Jackson used Robbie's proper name mainly when he was feeling rather stern. Those people murdered a man of God. No, excuse me, they murdered two men of God doing their duty. Trying to save the life of an innocent child, and one does not do business with murderers. I know that, and I don't like it any more than you do, and trust me, Jack Ryan doesn't like it any more than you do either. But when we make foreign policy for our country, we have to think things through, because if we screw it up, people can lose their lives. Lives have already been lost, Robert, Reverend Jackson pointed out. I know that. Look, Pap, I know more about this than you do, okay? I mean, we have ways of finding out stuff that doesn't make it on CNN, the vice president told his father, with the latest Zorga report right in his hand. Part of him wished that he could show it to his father, because his father was easily smart enough to